Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest, Plant Nursery and Consulting in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. I'm excited about today's show because it brings together two fields with a lot in common, although some people might be surprised to consider them related: regenerative ranching and permaculture design. Meat produced regeneratively adheres to permaculture design's ethics of people care, earth care, and fair share. Meat produced regeneratively nourishes humans, nourishes the earth, and nourishes ecosystems and communities for future generations. Regenerative ranching purposefully leverages animal impact on an ecosystem in order to build soil health, plant diversity, animal health, consumer health, and watershed health. My guest today is Glenn Elzinga of Alder Spring Ranch in May, Idaho. Their mission is to grow the best grass-fed beef they can and promote health in everything they do for the consumer, the land, the community their business supports, the cattle, and for their own family. Glenn, his wife Carol, who is a PhD plant ecologist, their seven daughters and one son-in-law, a handful of crew members, and a seasonal team of interns raise 400 head of organic grass-fed beef per year on 1,700 acres with a 46,000-acre wild rangeland permit. The entire operation has been certified organic for 15 years. Glenn Elzinga, welcome to the program.
Vanessa, it is fantastic to be here. And I think we don't have to do this podcast because your introduction covered everything that we're going to talk about. And you did a fantastic job there. But wait, there is some problems with what you're talking about. One thing, there's four son-in-laws now, not just one.
Oh, four son-in-laws. All right.
So they're all of marrying age, and unfortunately for your male listeners who might be interested in possibilities, I think the other three are dating pretty seriously right now. So I'm afraid you're too late. Snooze, you lose, guys. Sorry. So anyway,
you're in the business.
But that was a great introduction. You really actually covered it, and you tied things together really well.
Thank you. Well, I have my friend and mentor and landlord, Jared Kirst of Rivendell Farms, to thank for opening my eyes to that, because he had been on a 10-year journey discovering those things. And so I'm really excited to bring these insights to our listeners. So to start, in my introduction, I referred to earth care, people care, and fair share, the tenets of permaculture that align with regenerative ranching. And I'd love to discuss each of those individually with you. Starting with earth care, this might be the first time some of our listeners have heard that regenerative ranching can yield critical benefits to an ecosystem, especially with regard to soil health, plant diversity, and watershed health. What are the protocols and principles of regenerative ranching that conjure that earth care magic?
So, you know, that's actually a really huge question, but you can bring that whole thought train down to something very simple. I have an 8-year-old granddaughter. I could talk to her about regenerative ranching, and I could sum it up in just a very, very short elevator pitch with her, and she would repeat it back to me and totally get it. And this is what I tell people, and they say, what is regenerative? What does that even mean, especially in the context of the ranch? And for me, the test for regenerative is, are we increasing life, and are we increasing biodiversity? Or are we decreasing life and decreasing biodiversity? So, you know, to think about definitions like that, I always go to the extreme. I look at like a cornfield and say, are we increasing life? Well, you could theoretically say, yes, look at all this biomass there. We're building, you know, all these corn plants that are up to 12 feet high. Man, we're increasing life, you know, at scale. You know, we have an incredible amount of biomass, carbon per acre that we're raising here. This is fantastic. This might be regenerative, but then we test it with, are we increasing biodiversity? And the corn crop is an absolute failure there. So it's important to have both those things. So we're increasing the amount of life, the amount of biomass above the soil, below the soil, the animals that walk on it, whether they be our animals or you know, ecosystem visitors and tenants who live there all the time. You know, these are the elk, these are the wolves. These are the bighorn sheep. You know, they're all on the ecosystem that we share, as well as bull trout, threatened endangered species of salmon and steelhead. They all interact with that ecosystem. So they they are all part of that increase of life. But the key test then goes to, are we increasing biodiversity? And that's where I can bring my 8-year-old granddaughter up there and say, yes, we are, Papa. We're increasing biodiversity because there's bull trout in creeks that wasn't there before, because the creeks were muddy. Or there's aspen stands regenerating in this perched wetland that weren't there before because there were no aspen there. Or these rangeland grasslands on these uplands, on these high windy ridges, are now considered grasslands again instead of just sagebrush biomes. We used to say we're in the sagebrush ocean, and I still use that term to some degree, but we're actually coming onto the brink of a more grassland ocean that hasn't existed for about 120 years, ever since continuous grazing hit these wild ranges. So it's actually really simple, but it actually relates to real complexity in terms of what the biodiversity is and all these ecosystem interactions that I can't even begin to understand. So you're right, it is totally, building soils, building diverse soil biology, but that doesn't come until you've created biodiversity above ground and you've gotten your plant species back to an incredible diverse level that was in almost all these Rocky Mountain ecosystems before we got here. Like my wife, as you introduced her, Carol, she's a PhD plant ecologist. And so she's, kind of did a plant list of our rangeland, which is 70 square miles in central Idaho, and found, to both of our delight, that there was 2,100 native species up there. And I can safely say they're still there. I can say that that's still up there. And for a lot of people who raise, for instance, grass-fed beef, who don't have a chance to graze on these wild rangelands, with all these ecological niches and all these elevation gradients, we go all the way from low desert, which has lizards, horny toads, prickly pear cactus, barrel cactus, scorpions, lots of greasewood, all these like very deserty plants, all the way up to alpine tundra above timberline. You have species that are Arctic species way up there, in a completely different precipitation zone. Low elevation stuff is 2 to 3 inches effective precipitation on south aspects. High elevation stuff is up to 40. So you have this incredible ecotone gradient, going from all the way into River Canyon or the Salmon River, where our range starts, all the way up to alpine tundra and Arctic species up there, and these rainfall gradients. So that's really exciting because now you have this incredible, incredible biodiversity. And it's all these different biomes interacting with each other that we get to experience on our rangeland as we take our cattle through the 600-mile journey of grazing in wild country. So that's kind of a nutshell of how it's all coming together. We it's really about respect for what was there before we came, for these ecosystems, for these critters, for the vegetation that was there. And we're just trying to honor and respect that and bring it back to natural functionality. So let me give you a little example of how this works in our minds. Because, whether it be permaculture, whether it be, working in a nursery or working in an orchard or, working in a context like ours where we graze forest lands, it's really about our minds. It's really about how we see and how we perceive the world around us and how we fit in it. And so we have these interns that come every year and they come on for 5 weeks and I'm laughing because, boy, those first few days, they are so thrown into this cauldron of sometimes despair for them because they're like, I've never worked this hard in my life. Or, what about sleep? Do we get to sleep ever? Or, when are we going to eat next? Because I'm dying here. I'm dying, and they eat like incredible amounts of calories, but far more than they would ever think. Or their rear end hurts, Vanessa, because they've never ridden 14 to 16, sometimes 18 hours a day on horseback, and they get brushed off their horse in dark timber, or their horse goes bucking, or the cattle get out, or there's all these things that they've never had to deal with. Almost, it's almost ubiquitous with all of our interns that they thought they were ready, but they weren't. And so there's some weeping and gnashing of teeth in that first week. And then at the end of the 5 weeks, here's the weird deal. I'll bring some of them to the airport or get them to where their rides waiting for them to pick them up. And both guys and gals, will just hug and I'll shake their hand and say, thank you very much. And almost invariably, Vanessa, there's tears in their eyes. And you'd think, oh, maybe they're tears of just pain and so grateful to be done with this. But the reality is, the tears are because I think something changed in their mind. And I think they came thinking that they were going to like act on an ecosystem. They were going to act on these rangelands. They were going to move these cattle and get this grass off. And they were going to take something from these rangelands. And at the end of it, I think they begin to see that that's not what we're about at all. That what we're about is becoming part of that ecosystem, part of those biomes up there. Instead of acting, and you see these little hints of it because you'll have wolves howling above camp and they're no longer eating our cattle. They haven't eaten our cattle now for 12 years. And we're okay with it. And we actually will all get out of the cook shack. I remember one night, it was 11 p.m. Everybody's exhausted. It's pitch dark. There's a moon out. And they put down their plates and step out. And they hear these wolves howling above camp. And it's wonder, not fear or dread. And that's what strikes me as the change, the sea change I see in these kids that come out. Because they're not part of a functioning ecosystem. It's not this adversarial thing where we're going to get this grass or we're going to punch these cattle or drive them here. No, we've just developed these relationships with the land and even with the cattle. The number one reason I yell at my crew in the beginning, I do raise my voice with them because I want them to get this. And you're talking over hundreds of yards there on horseback on the other side of the herd. It is the hardest thing in the world, but I just want to get them to realize that they got to respect those cattle and they got to create some pressure to get the cattle to want to do what you need them to do. That's key. You don't make the cattle do anything. You get the cattle want to do what you need them to do. And in order to do that, it takes a lot more finesse on horseback than just punching them or driving them or going yip yow. Like, I don't even let people yell. They're not allowed to raise their voice at my cattle. We can raise our voice at each other to be heard, across great distances, but we can't yell at the cattle. There's no whistling, there's no whipping, there's no yippee-yi-yo on our range with those cattle. We don't move cattle by raising our voices. We move them by building relationship of pressure with a whole bunch of release. And so it takes a lot to get that into them. But when we get those tools in place with these young people, they then realize we can ask the cattle to go anywhere. And when you can ask the cattle to go anywhere and control them completely, that means that we can actually be an ecosystem tool. And we can provide a service to the ecosystem because we can ask our cattle to do anything and go anywhere. We can say, hey, we're going to go through this aspen stand, but it's in the process of regeneration. And that means we're going to move fast. And where there's good grass in the aspen stand, we're just going to lightly graze it. And they'll never touch the woody plants because cattle don't eat woody plants as a choice. They're going to take the grass every time. So we're going to graze quickly through this aspen stand because we're trying to preserve the regeneration here. And I'll tell the crew, if I get a ride away and do a scouting mission to see where we're going next, I'll say, I do not want one of those aspen trees to have a nip off it because we want them. We need that diversity in timber cover, and we need a break from the conifer stands, and we need these aspen to regenerate, and you're in charge of making that happen. So that's, those little stories are kind of a sum total of what that vision looks like. It's you're not intentional in saying, oh gosh, we're going to build soil biodiversity. We're going to get that microbiome under our feet really cranking. You don't think that way. There's no intentionality about doing that. Instead, you put all the parts together in your head. Aldo Leopold said the key of intelligent tinkering, and I'm paraphrasing this, I'm sure, is to ensure that we have all the pieces and parts. And that's where we are. We're at this place where we're starting to see all the pieces and parts fall into place. So now we can intelligently tinker our way to better ecosystem success. When we see that biodiverse ecosystem of those trees, of those aspens, doing really well, stuff like soil biology starts falling into place because we're reinstating, maybe the water cycle by reinstating plant cover. And water cycles, as you know, are broken all through the West. We're just evapotranspirating too much, but we're evaporating too much. It's even beyond the plants. We're just evaporating off bare soil. And so our job is, hey, we don't want bare soil. We want soil covered. And we're going to use our cattle to encourage that to happen. So that was a long answer to your question, but I hope I touched on how we get there.
Well, I love how the story about the interns mirrors two of the permaculture principles, which are to observe and interact. And in this way, as range riders, you are a part of the system. And also how you're obtaining multiple yields, not only growing beef and building ecosystem health, but you're also training those interns and opening their eyes to the world where they are an important part of the system. But I do want to step back and boil down two important concepts just to make sure our listeners understand. So how you mentioned how some of the riparian areas are growing back because they're not staying muddy. And if you can also explain what is selective grazing and why are you preventing it and why it's important.
Those are great questions, and they're actually super related. So, the first thing, let's talk about the riparian system. So, about 30, I think it was 14 years ago now, we lost a lot of cattle to wolf predation. And it's because we're turning our cattle out, like most people do in the West, in early May, open the gate basically, and put them up there. And we tried to herd them from riparian areas, by going up there every day on horseback. The daughters and I would go up there and try to push these animals off of riparian system. So there's 250 mama cows up there with their babies. So that's, 500 animals up there, Vanessa, on 70 square miles. And you can probably imagine what kind of luck we had on getting those cattle off riparian areas on 70 square miles. So we'd find like maybe 50 or 60. We'd take them and herd them up onto a plateau. We'd settle them. We'd back off. We'd just let them rest, get their heads down grazing so they're super comfortable. This is called parking cattle. It's kind of a stockmanship approach. So you want to pull all the stress off them, create great release, and park those cattle up there. And it kind of worked for a few days. They would go down to water and go up to their parking area where you last settled them. But eventually, cattle like these two things. They both start with a G. One is green. So guess what? As you get later in the summer, they like that color green, and it's along the 55 miles of creek we have there. And then they like following the force of gravity. That's the other G. So it's green and gravity. Cattle are big animals, 1,200 pounds, and they don't like going back uphill to that plateau that where we settled them. And they're creatures of habit, and they're just like us. And they'll go to that same coffee shop every morning because it's the one they know. And they'll just hang out in that coffee shop and eat some Danish, and that's the riparian area for them. They just dwell down there, and it's because there's a lot of tasty, succulent sugar-rich species in riparian areas, and there's a lot of shade, and there's no gravity to deal with, and they have water right there. So they're like, they're opportunists, and they will say, "I'm going to just stay here." So we'd go back in 3 days to that particular herd after finding another one over the other 2 days, and we moved them out, and we found out that, after 3 or 4 days, our cattle that were parked on an upland, wise in their minds, they wisely came down to this riparian area where they don't have to walk clear up that mountain anymore. Water's right there. It's just energy conservation for them. So you can't blame a cow. So our country that I was practicing forestry in, I was a professional forester and did that for 15 years. Very similar to what you got around Glenwood. A lot of conifer forest up high mixed with aspen, and but our aspen is actually more degraded than yours. You have like pretty intact aspen stands. It seems like our aspen are probably like 20 years further down the road than yours. And as a result, you get more and more conifer encroachment, losing this whole aspen component. And so that's where I jumped into trying to figure out that deal to maintain aspen, because that diversity, that biodiversity of aspen inclusion, is just really important. It's important for everything. It's important for water. It's important for wildlife. It's just so critical to have that diverse habitat in our forests. And they were all being encroached by Douglas fir and lodgepole pine, and we're losing them all.
You have to
And so,
manage succession.
yeah, and so that was succession. But in the absence of fire, Vanessa, here you are. Here we are. We're stuck with this problem now because all the conifer encroachment, super prone to being wiped out by fire. In our fire interval, we discovered after tree ring studies throughout all of our low elevation timber stands that our fire frequency was around 45 years. And here we've gone now about 100 since the last fire.
Wow.
And so now what you have, because conifers have those low branches when they come up, super susceptible to fire. And we think, oh, aspen aren't going to survive a fire either, but they are. And why are they going to survive, Vanessa? Why?
The roots.
The roots are all alive, right? They're the biggest living organism on Earth. Have you heard about this? I think it's called Pando. The largest organism on Earth is on Fish Lake National Forest in Utah. And in fact, I drove by Pando one day unknowingly, but then found out, oh my gosh, that was Pando, the largest organism on Earth. And it's like 150 acre aspen stand. So the reason why it's a single organism is because it's all clonal. So they are all the same and they're all connected underground. So you run a fire through Pando, and it's probably the best thing that could happen to it. Because fire actually creates a thermal pulse into the soil that actually really invigorates and engages aspen roots to sprout. So that's really exciting. And meanwhile, you wiped out your conifers, right? So the slate is clean. These aspen come up. It doesn't matter about competition from grasses and forbs and even shrubs, because these aspen are already there. They're already, have this huge root system ready to go and ready to crank it out and put those solar panels back up, and we call them trees, and start collecting sugars and all that wonderful stuff from sunlight and gathering rainfall. And it's just a beautiful thing. But anyway, so here I am practicing this forestry, trying to get these prescribed fires in there. And there's this one thing that I just came to hate. And I say, we call them range maggots. We call them range lice. We just hated this one agent that would always get in the way of our aspen regeneration, get in the way of our prescribed fire plans. Super obstructionary. Any idea what it was?
Public opinion. No.
Well, actually, public opinion is part of this thing. It's very complicated. And anyway, they were cows. They were range cows. But my neighbors came
Unsupervised.
unsupervised range cows going out on public lands. And guess what? They're eating my aspen regeneration.
Right.
We have a ton of elk. So if you put elk on there and elk browse, they like to eat some of these elk aspen. They eat some willows, especially in the changing of seasons. But you add cows to the compounding problem. If you got elk and moose in your country, and then you add bovines on top of it, you're not going to win with your aspen regeneration. You're just going to lose all the time, time and time again. You're going to see your plants, your new shoots get just grubbed off by all these browsers. And the cows were the thing that tipped the balance and made us lose. So I hated them. I had my fist up, cows, and it was just grazing on public lands that I was like, oh my gosh, what a nightmare. So ironically, this is where life goes sometimes, Vanessa. I turned out to be one of the cow guys
Exactly.
because we bought a ranch. And so I turned into this hate to love relationship when I realized that there was a way to run the cows up there and actually enhance these sorts of problems.
That's right.
What we're doing on these public lands is actually a permaculture right now, today, because we're grazing in these forests, and we found a way to do that where the forests win and we win, but best of all, the eaters of the beef win because they get this huge biodiversity picture of all these different compounds that wild lands can offer. I can't get the diversity of compounds and the complexity of chemical diversity that's important for human nutrition at home, grazing our irrigated pastures.
As our listeners can see, Glenn is a font of inspiration and knowledge. So much so that I'll be dividing our discussion into two or maybe even three parts. So look out for next month's episode where we'll continue our conversation together. If you'd like to follow up with Glenn, Elzinga, and Alder Spring Ranch, you can find their website at alderspring.com. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Tune in next month on KDNK on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture. I'll talk to you then.